are we once again on the cusp of nuclear catastrophe? It's a concern that hung over the entire world like the sword of Damocles for half a century. At the peak, in 1980, there were more than 61,000 nuclear weapons in the world. Former U.S. President Ronald Reagan and Soviet General Secretary Mikhail Gorbachev recognized the threat two powerful nations on hair trigger alert posed. Between them, they had enough stored energy to destroy the world. In October 1986, in Reykjavik, Iceland, they began talks that have led to a series of arms reduction agreements. The latest, the New START agreement, will expire in February of 2021. Despite the reduction in nuclear arms, the explosive potential in the hands of eight nations that control just shy of 15,000 nukes is deadly. Bruce Blair of the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs says there are two elements that make the current situation so dangerous. One, almost no one is paying attention. And two, Russia and the USA maintain a rapid response protocol. During the Cold War, the launch protocol was never fully activated. Over the past 10 years, however, Blair says, on multiple occasions, there have been ambiguous ballistic threats that rose to the level of presidential participation. And under Presidents Bush and Obama, the launch protocol was activated. In each case, cooler heads prevailed, and what was believed to be imminent danger turned out to be a false alarm. We invited research scholar Bruce Blair to join us for a conversation that matters about the rising risk nuclear weapons and response protocols pose.
Conversations That Matter is a partner program for the Center for Dialogue at Simon Fraser University. The production of this program is made possible thanks to the support of the following and viewers like you.
Welcome.
Thanks. It's good to be with you.
Thanks for joining me. I say that with a certain amount of trepidation because, you know, I can think back in my life in the 70s and 80s, we all ran around figuring that we were on a hairpin trigger just moments from the nuclear meltdown. The alarm clock was going to ring and we were going to perish.
Yeah.
That seems to have gone away. You know, we had the disassembling of the USSR, and it looked like, especially through the Yeltsin years and Clinton working with Yeltsin, that we were going to be moving towards an elimination of nuclear weapons. When I read your stuff, you're saying, maybe we should start paying attention to it again.
Well, it did go away in the 90s. After the end of the Cold War, no one thought about it at all, except for a few folks like Senator Nunn and me and others who worried about loose nukes, that as the Soviet Union fell apart, these weapons may fall into the hands of terrorists.
And they did, didn't they?
And to some extent they did. There were about 25 serious smuggling cases of highly enriched uranium that got out, that got loose from the former Soviet Union. But otherwise everyone thought things were fine with the Russians. The Russians were not happy. These were not happy days for the Russians because they were suffering enormous economic distress. That's why we worried about loose nukes. About the sale of materials out of the Soviet Union, and also NATO was expanding, but that bothered the Russians. But they were on their knees and they couldn't do anything. And now they're back up on their feet. And under Putin, things have really turned rather tense and ugly in the relationship between Russia and the West and the United States.
So, do you think we are experiencing another Cold War now?
Well, I wouldn't put it quite that way, because during the Cold War, we really did brandish nuclear weapons. You know, I was on alert once as a missile launch officer when we got a message to prepare to launch up to 50 of our nuclear missiles, which were almost all aimed at the Soviet Union. And the idea was to send a message to the Soviet leadership not to do something. And
they knew that you were on already at that point where you were ready to launch. Was that signal then being sent?
The signal was sent not so much by me, because we were in an underground launch center, but the whole U.S. military went on a higher level of nuclear alert. And a lot of that was very visible with bombers and submarines and the like. But we were literally preparing for the possibility that this crisis, which is over the Arab-Israeli war, actually, could escalate to a nuclear level. And so we were sending a message to the Russians that we were prepared to risk stumbling into a nuclear war to get our way. And so we're not quite at that level of body language.
Mm-hmm. We've had today. A couple of moments where it's been close. Were it not for the calm thinking of, I believe there was an American, was it a submarine commander who had been given an order to launch and said, no, something's not right.
Well, that was a Russian submarine.
Oh, that
commander.
Was a Russian submarine.
Yeah, during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And then there was another false alarm in 1983 where a Russian colonel, who I know very well, Stanislav Petrov, I hosted him at my home, detected the satellites detected a U.S. nuclear Minuteman missile launch from the middle western United States against the Soviet Union. My missiles, actually.
Because you were in launch command.
Pardon?
You were stationed at launch command.
I was in the strategic command.
Yeah.
And it was my job to fire missiles upon direction from the Pentagon. But he didn't believe these early warning indications. It was a gut instinct, and he was a very courageous and smart guy who decided to declare a false alarm, uh-huh. even though all the computers said it was a real attack. So there have been, over the period of the Cold War, lots of close calls, including on the U.S. side, usually caused by computer malfunction.
Mm-hmm.
President Carter's National Security Advisor Brzezinski was told in the middle of the night, three times, that we were under full-scale attack. And he was picking up the phone to call Carter, President Carter, to tell him that he had to make a decision immediately to order the retaliation by U.S. forces. And just at that moment, another call came in and said, whoops, this was a false alarm. But, you know, none of these ever rose to the level of the president. They were never contacted. Mm-hmm. During these false alarms on the
business. That's in the United States, but in 1995 in Russia, it was quite a different situation, wasn't it?
In 95, actually, that was during detente. I mean, that was Yeltsin, and we were not, you know, really enemies any longer. And so I think that particular false alarm has been hyped, to be honest. But I wanted to make a really important point, which is that over the last 10 years, there have been, on multiple occasions, ambiguous ballistic missile threats against the United States that have risen to the level of the president. The launch protocol was never fully activated during the Cold War involving the president.
Mm-hmm.
On numerous occasions in the last 10 years, it has been activated and has involved Presidents Bush and Obama. I don't know about Trump. Don't have any information on that. But there has been this proliferation of ballistic missiles around the world. Everybody's getting them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, China, India, Pakistan, Iraq, Iran, you name it. Every country is getting ballistic missiles. And they're firing them left and right. So every single day, maybe while we're talking here, there are events that involve phenomenology that require that our early warning teams take a look to see if we're under attack. That probably the Japanese putting up a civilian satellite or this or that, but you know, it could be the North Koreans firing a missile that we don't know for sure where it's gonna go. So we actually are living now through a period of greater ambiguity and potential for false alarms than we were during the Cold War.
Are you more concerned about the actual detonation or the reality of some kind of an event that can trigger a much larger conflict? Are you more concerned about it now than you were during the Cold War?
Between the United States and Russia, the political tensions have not reached Cold War proportions. So I'm not worried about an intentional confrontation that leads to nuclear war. I continue to worry about inadvertent escalation. And right now, the United States and Russia are sort of throwing each other's weight around quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a huge spike in the number of military incidents since 2014, when Russia meddled in Ukraine and seized Crimea.
Mm-hmm.
Several-fold increase in the number of, say, NATO intercepts of Russian aircraft. There are hundreds of them every year now.
Well, and the shooting down of the Russian MiG over Syrian airspace by Turkish troops.
By Turkish troops. And also, I mean, you have to count other things that have happened, including the shoot down of the Malaysian civilian aircraft. A lot of bad things have happened in mm-hmm. recent years. The number of military exercises, Russian and NATO, continue to rise. So we are kind of in this phase of kind of a tropical storm that does have the potential to escalate, because everyone thinks that they're just responding defensively to things that are going on the other side. Mm-hmm. But in the process, both sides project threat at each other. They mm-hmm. don't fully grasp that. So we could be looking at kind of a World War I, Guns of August, March escalation, action, reaction, that gets nasty and may acquire a nuclear dimension. I worry about that. But around the world, there are huge flat nuclear flashpoints that lead me to believe that one of the nine countries with nuclear weapons mm-hmm. today are going, one of them is going to use a nuclear weapon either by design or accident in, you know, some in our lifetime.
In the midst of all of this, President Trump has not moved towards de-escalation. Rather, he's moving towards an increase in launch vehicles and the number of weapons.
Well, you know, whatever President Trump says, he says. The fact is, right. You know, there's this inertia in our system. We've had a nuclear and conventional modernization program underway for many years, and so it just keeps, moving along. And whatever, you know, Trump changes his mind left and right, it doesn't really matter what he says. I would ignore that. You never know. He's too erratic to make any bets on the future of U.S. military security policy on what he says.
Currently, how many nuclear weapons do we know of that exist in the world?
Well, there are around 15,000.
15,000. Yeah,
but there were 70,000 in the 1980s. So mm-hmm. there's been like an 85% reduction. But the bad news is that it only takes a few to destroy a country.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yes.
So we are a long way away from escaping the grip of sort of mutual assured destruction and potentially a huge catastrophe for the world as a whole. You know, the nuclear weapons effects are not confined to the warring parties.
Right.
There are externalities that affect the non-belligerent countries, and even a small-scale nuclear war today, say one between India and Pakistan, mm-hmm. 100 nuclear weapons
between
out of the 15,000 in the world, 100 nuclear weapons, according to scientists using the latest climate models, could inject enough soot into the stratosphere to block the sun to a degree that lowers the temperature of the Earth for at least a season or two by a couple of degrees mm-hmm. Fahrenheit. That cuts short the harvest season by a week or two mm-hmm. weeks, and according to their calculations, could lead to starvation throughout the world that could kill millions and millions of people.
And that can be from a regional conflict.
And that could be just a fight between India and Pakistan, each of which have a couple, say they each have over 100 nuclear weapons right now.
Mm-hmm.
And if they exploded them on the big cities in South Asia, they would ignite gigantic fires, and the firestorms would throw a tremendous amount of dust and soot into the atmosphere that would literally block out the sun.
So we know that the United States and Russia have sort of a triangulated approach as far as launch vehicles are concerned. You've got silos in the ground, you've got airborne, and then you've got submarine-based weapons. Do some of these other countries have that triple threat as well, or are they primarily restricted to a land-based launch?
Well, the United Kingdom and France basically only have submarines now. They used to have all variety of different weapons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we used to have small mini nukes that were fired by bazookas. We deployed those by the thousands in Europe. So the NATO allies used to have a wide variety of different platforms.
Mm-hmm.
But now UK and France basically have submarines. The other countries like China, India, Pakistan have a small number of weapons, but they're increasingly diversifying into this triad idea of sort of multiple platforms on, at sea, aircraft, and missiles on the, on land. And so, for example, China right now is deploying 6 submarines that can launch ballistic missiles with nuclear weapons against Russia or the United States. And this is the first time that they've really had that capability. And they're putting them in the South China Sea. That's why we're fighting with China over control over the South China Sea.
Because we don't want those submarines being stationed there.
Because we want to be able to destroy them in the event of war with China. We want to be able to sink China's nuclear-armed submarines. There are 6 of them, and they would be patrolling in the South China Sea during a crisis, and we want to be in a position to sink them. Now, we haven't given up the idea of nuclear war fighting. We talk about, you know, destroying each other's cities, and that certainly, almost certainly would happen in wartime, but we still, we in the Soviets, the Russians in particular, still plan to try to destroy the other side's nuclear forces in during wartime.
You, with a number of leaders around the world, have gone and created Global Zero. What's your objective?
If we don't get rid of nuclear weapons, they're going to be used in our lifetime. There are too many different scenarios for their use, either by accident or by design. I mean, for example, Pakistani weapons have no safety features on them.
What do you hope that those same people who have mobilized to say, we've got to do something to address the climate, what can they do with this information that can help you, hopefully, de-escalate the situation?
Well, that's the $64,000 question. How do you mobilize people to pay attention to this question, which is an existential threat, like climate change?
Right.
Climate change is suicide slowly. Nuclear war is suicide quickly, and they're both existential threats. And so Global Zero's first effort was to produce the film called Countdown to Zero that was produced by the same team that produced Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth.
Well, you know, I can recall we used to have marches down the streets here in Vancouver. Vancouver was going to be declared a nuclear weapons free zone. American visiting naval ships, when they came into port, were supposed to declare that they did not have nuclear weapons on board. Nobody shows up for any of that anymore.
Well, I'm trying to change that. And Global Zero's mission is to try to wake people up to this. I think that two things have helped move us in that direction. One is the election of Donald Trump.
Because he scares everybody.
He scares everyone. And you know, people worry about this guy with his finger on the nuclear button because there are no checks and balances on the President of the United States. There's no one that could veto his order to use nuclear weapons. He basically has direct command and control over thousands of nuclear weapons, 800 of which are ready to be fired in about 5 to 10 minutes.
So is that what you call the hair trigger response?
Well, one of the big concerns of mine, and it has been for decades actually, is that we and the Russians keep our nuclear missiles on launch ready alert. And that means that the missiles themselves, they're armed, they're targeted, they're fueled, and they will fire as soon as they receive a short stream of computer code. If we ordered the firing of those missiles right now from the Kremlin or the White House, a launch message would go down the length of that's a length of a tweet to the crews. And then in 1 minute, I was a Minuteman launch officer, in 1 minute we could carry out the launch checklist and fire those missiles. They'd be leaving their silos 1 minute later. That is sort of a checklist-driven process. It's also found to be kind of a rote process of decision-making if the president is notified that we're under attack. There's only a few minutes to brief the president. He only has a few minutes to make a decision. So that's sort of a hair trigger process. But technically, in the field, the missiles are ready to go. What if a hacker manages to penetrate this allegedly hermetically sealed launch control system, which it's not hermetically sealed? Top to bottom, bottom to top, we operate a system on waivers. That is to say, our officials cannot certify that our critical nuclear command and control and communication system is bug-free. It may have malware in it. We don't even know it.
So is our safest bet then to, first of all, focus on getting rid of these silo-based, land-based weapons?
So my recommendation and that of Global Zero is that we stand down these arsenals so they're no longer on hair trigger alert, that it would take a long period of time to get them ready to fire. Just like they were, you know, back in the day, you know, way back in the day, we did not have these weapons on air trigger alert. And guess who's following in our footsteps? India, China, Pakistan. Pretty soon we're going to have like 8-9 countries with weapons on air trigger alert. And it's a accident waiting to happen, isn't it? So stand down these weapons and then get, for Pete's sakes, get, you know, into the room together and start talking about how to ramp down this escalating tension between our countries, because we're not even talking. I mean, the foreign minister of global affairs of Canada is banned from Russia. The NATO and Russia have suspended their military to military talks. We are not talking. That's why really I'm here in Vancouver to sort of try to figure out a way to facilitate a dialogue.
Yeah, well, and part of that is to mobilize individual thought and action amongst as many people as possible, because they motivate our political leaders. It doesn't matter which jurisdiction you live in. You get enough people who are worked up about something, the leaders listen.
In democracies like ours, grassroots activism counts and moves the needle of policies. Unfortunately, there are other countries like China and Russia that don't have any real sort of bottom-up pressure on their decision makers. Mm-hmm. But we have to be careful that we try to bring all these countries into a dialogue and not just put the pressure on our own officials to take steps.
I want you to be successful.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thanks a lot.